Welcome to part two of Advocating in Healthcare. Join us for the continuing discussion where we look further at the subject of being involved in your healthcare, as well as advocating for others in need.
So, Dr. Southall, we did talk about the release of your book, Playing with Bees. It looks inside the healthcare system, how resistance to change has affected healthcare. There's a lot more in there. I can tell you that reading it myself, it was very eye-opening. First of all, where can we find your book?
It's on Amazon. So,
Amazon.
Just Playing with Bees in Southwick, and it comes up.
Awesome. And if you could give one major takeaway from your book that you would want somebody to get out of reading it, what would that be? There's a lot there, but you know.
Yeah, I think one of the big problems, and Julio can speak to this as well, anybody that's been harmed or a family member been harmed, is why is it so slow? Why aren't we changing? Why haven't one of the big problems is this was really 2000 is when the Institute of Medicine wrote a white paper called To Err is Human. And yet there was a study in 2023 from actually Boston, where the original, a lot of the doctors were that called for this improvement and, you know, reduce errors. They find that the number of errors in healthcare when you're hospitalized hadn't decreased at all, despite all our efforts. And so, and the reason is what we just animated is doctors are resistant to change. And we really need to embrace innovation. And one of the things, I just came from a conference on artificial intelligence and the use of the electronic record. And I do think that with the guidance of artificial intelligence and actually ChatGPT ways of structuring communication, such as the iPass system, but making it automatic so that the doctor doesn't initiate it, the computer record initiates that kind of communication. I think we can eventually get a really seamless and integrated system. And so I am very optimistic that we're at the cusp of a major, major change that will be very, very good for patients. So I'm very excited about that. And one of the important things when someone say, will you give them something new to do? They say, oh, yeah, I'm doing it. But they aren't doing it. But you don't have time to check on them. The beauty of the electronic record and creating algorithms and filters, you can actually see what someone is doing and give them feedback. And feedback is the key to all this. And doctors are very sensitive to feedback. They all want to get A's. So I think that if we can get this feedback meaningfully and timely and couch it in positive terms, this is a form of coaching. We want to make you better. We want to make the system better. I think we can get the changes that we were hoping for. Sharon Cerenzi has got a comment. Sharon, can you briefly tell us a little about yourself? Because you and Victoria are very similar. And then ask your question.
Yes, I'm also an ordained clergy in the Methodist Church, and I have a ministry in Hawthorne called the Hawthorne Area Resource Center, which is a food pantry and an information and referral facility. So we interact with the community and try to connect them to services. Even though we're a very rural area, most of their services will be in Gainesville. This is a very interesting podcast. And a question I have for the group is, do you have any experience with maybe community-based health literacy courses or classes and how effective those are? I've done some individually, but not like opened it up to the whole community.
Julia, would you like to respond to that?
Yes, I think those types of classes are very, very useful. And I've led those types of classes in the past, as have other advocates. And we always got great feedback. People felt that they were very, very valuable. It's just that they're hard to sustain. It's hard to find on a very, very limited budget or no budget, you know, a location to do that. How do you reach the people that want to be at the course? Certainly online, like these podcasts, is probably the best way to do it, but not everybody has access to technology. So actually physically going out in the community is important, but it's hard to find, you know, basically a small army of people who are educated to do that, willing to do that, willing to follow up, willing to ask a lot of questions, make themselves accessible. So I do think that's ultimately, you know, a big part of the solution. And people like pastors, visiting nurses, even we see a lot of church groups, very informally, people dropping off meals or just checking on other members in their church. If we can reach those people, you know, that's even helpful. It might just be one or two people at a time. It would be better to reach 20 or 30 or 100 people sitting in a community center all at once, but it isn't always possible to do that. But, you know, we do have to start somewhere. And I do think that things like artificial intelligence are important. I mean, we thought the electronic medical record was going to really blow the top off of patient safety, which it hasn't. My daughter passed away in the year 2000, which is when that report to Air as Human came out. A lot of advocates thought this is it. We're standing on the brink now of a big, significant change. And we just can never seem to get over that mountaintop. And I think that all people involved having a little bit more information. We need to bring the patient's IQ up. They need to know at least a basic amount of information. All the people in their orbit, anybody who's able to help them, bring up their IQ and then have a system that's welcoming of that. At least that would give us, you know, a chance, I think.
Sharon, Victoria, one thing I was wondering about is, could you identify representatives in the church that could serve this role? One of the problems is just one-time events don't really fill the bill, because often you're not paying attention if it hasn't happened to you. But when it does happen, then you want all that information. You will probably have forgotten it. But if there were, if your churches had one or two people that were really interested in this, I think that through the Right Care Alliance, that is one of our missions, actually, is we're continually talking about what ideal care should look like. And I think what would happen is, yeah, you can give little formal talks, but it really takes just working and discussing over and over with the system to understand it. And even I don't completely understand it. I don't think anybody does. We have a crazy quilt of insurance coverage, of you know, what will be allowed, what will be paid for, won't be paid for. It's really very, very complicated. But if each of you could appoint or encourage parishioners to become involved, that would be a great way. And then what would happen is we would get to know them. There are several other doctors in the Right Care Alliance, and we would know them. They would know us. They could. I would be happy to answer questions, and Julia would also. But they need to know who to go to, and I think we can. And that's one of the real roles, I think, of the Right Care Alliance, as to serve as a resource for patients.
Yes, I think that is very doable. There's a number of people that I have, they're not medical, they don't have a medical background, but they're very caring and compassionate people. And as a nurse, I'm going to be coaching them on how to work with the families that they come across, and what questions to ask. So yes, something like having a resource like that would be great, Fred.
And Julia's website is, Julia, I want you just, you've written all these, some of the things you have on that website, because I think the members of your parish could look at those and become familiar with them, and then actually lead patients that have questions to those resources. One of the big problems I think Julia found is, you can tell more, Julia, but you actually offered all these tools free to hospitals, and since they didn't have to pay for it, they didn't value it, and they didn't want to use them.
Well, I think even more than that was they were just intimidated to have those types of resources for patients. I think it wasn't even the cost. I think it was way out of their comfort zone to be educating patients and their advocates to that level. And they would tell us things like, well, we're going to have to run it through our legal department. There were so many roadblocks to making it happen. We certainly identified lots of people in the hospital who were interested, lots of nurses, lots of social workers. And when they would take it up the chain of command, it would die off at that point. It just couldn't get past committees and lawyers and administrators. So we realized that wasn't realistic, to do it that way. So our resources on the side are broken up into categories. So there's hospitalization, patient safety, there's second opinions, that sort of thing. And there are some resources from outside places that we found very valuable, some from the government, the CDC, and a lot of them we wrote ourselves. I worked with other advocates. We worked using our own experiences, doing our own research, talking to physicians, nurses, people involved in the system. What are the kind of things that people should ask, should be aware of? There are many, many things that people can do to prevent infection, to how to get a second opinion, questions to ask before you have a surgical procedure, things even like a rounding sheet, Fred, that you and I worked on. So when your team comes in for rounds, you have your own little rounding sheet that you can check off things. You can to organize your thoughts, your questions. We have communication forms, how to succinctly ask your questions to your team in the way that they understand. That's a system that they use themselves in the hospital. So we tried to make things very basic, as easy as possible, very streamlined and free, just open to the public to download, to share. We really don't have any idea how many people are using those resources, but it's many more, I think, than we even know. I think they've been widely shared through a lot of social working groups and pastor groups and things like that. So people are using them and they're very, very helpful.
Yeah, I agree. I've looked through the website and it's just so much information. Because
Joe has a question.
No, thank you. Thank you. Great conversation. And
Joe, introduce yourself. Please.
I'm Joe Lyons, and I've had a career in healthcare finance and administration. And I'm currently with a company that's focused on hospital at home, trying to keep people home when they don't really need to be in the hospital. And frankly, that's a lead up into my question. Since we got this company going 4 years ago, we've gotten to the habit of recording our meetings routinely so that those who can't attend can view the meeting, see what happened. And then we also have a command center. And yeah, we basically record all the phone calls with patients, et cetera. We begin by telling them you're speaking on a recorded line and why we do that, because it's all about, making sure. And I'm just wondering about the notion of bringing the video camera into an exam room. So, doctor, I'm not going to capture, not in an oppositional or aggressive way, but just to say, I know I'm not going to be able to comprehend everything you say. I want to listen to what you say two or three times. And so I just wonder whether we're going to, get to that point or if we are there already and how folks and how clinicians might react to that.
I actually have had one or two patients do that. I thought it was fine. I don't know how other doctors would take that. The fear is litigation. You said this, I have this recorded, you said this, and then it turned out that that wasn't correct. And this is a problem. I've got to tell you, medicine is not an exact science often, and you may throw out possible diagnoses that later subsequently prove not to be true. And so there is a little bit of fear that recording what is said on rounds could then be used against you. So I would have to talk to our lawyers actually about that particular concern. And it could lead to a distrustful relationship. And once the doctor and the patient aren't trusting each other, you really have a problem. So I don't know. That's a really tricky one. I know one place we're doing recording now is the OR. They are actually doing recordings of the surgery in a number of places. And then if something goes wrong, they can actually go back. And theoretically, you could also go back if it's a new resident didn't do it quite right. You could go back and go over what they did and why it should be improved. Just like game films in athletics, where you your goal is to improve how they're working. But I think the recording and a rounding system could be a double-edged sword. I don't know, Julia, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think every time I've encountered a patient or family member who's tried that, they've been completely shot down. It's just not allowed that I've ever heard. They don't even like patients taking photos of their own wounds and things like that, which I think is ridiculous. I certainly think taking a photo of your own body is always allowable. But as far as video or audio recording, I've not seen that been well received at all.
So that brings us to one last point that I want to throw out. And this is to everybody. We talk about the involvement and things that we can do. I want to talk about the involvement beyond just our own personal care, getting out into the community and helping. We've heard several different ways. It's one of the reasons I joined the Right Care Alliance. I wanted to make a difference, not just for myself, but with the community. To all of you, what can people do to help not just themselves, but help in their communities go a little bit further? Not everybody wants to join an organization like we have, and that's fine. I wish they would, but at the same point, there's other things. So, and I can start with Dr. Southwick, your thought.
Well, the Right Care Alliance, we try to pick topics where we think we can make a difference by publicizing through op-eds, through various town hall meetings, where we try to gather large numbers of people. I think through podcasts. This is an entirely new venue that I think is very exciting. I'm very excited about this. So, so we initially looked at the price of insulin. I think now when we started, very few people knew how expensive insulin or what the problems with insulin. Now it's, you hear about it. Oh yeah, we know about insulin. Oh yeah, it's gotta be $30 a month and not $1,000 a month. So people now know. So we got that one through. We worked on a drug called Aduhelm, which is a monoclonal antibody that bound amyloid and reduced amyloid in the brain. It turned out that as far as cognitive improvement, there's no significant cognitive improvement, and is associated with brain hemorrhages and brain swelling. So, and yet it got approved by the FDA. Well, we wrote a letter. We helped in a letter campaign to Medicare. I encouraged them not to cover it, and they did not cover it unless you were in a clinical trial. And now we're focusing on medical debt and what a terrible problem this is. And the even those that are insured, we have large deductibles now. In individual, on average now, is about $5,000 to $6,000. In other words, before the insurance company pays, you have to pay the first $5,000 to $6,000. And for a family, it can be $12,000. Oh, my goodness. You're insured, but you're not. You're insured if you have an absolute catastrophe. But if you've got routine care, you're really not covered. And yet you're paying premiums every month for something you don't ever use. So these are some of the challenges that need to be publicized. Another one that I think we want to get more into. And I think, how we do this, I think podcasts, I think town hall meetings, and editorials are probably the major ways. Another one is Medicare Advantage. I got news for you. It's an advantage for the insurance companies and not for the patients. They make a big profit. They make a 20% profit over standard Medicare. Now, where that money is going to them, not to your care. And so these are some of the issues that we're working on that you can help by educating others. You can help by writing editorials. You could help. In some cases, one thing we've noticed in our area is the cost, the publicized charge for individual procedures or treatments very drastically, to the point we had a routine ER visit in at University of Florida, it's about $800. And for Columbia, North Florida, it's $5,000. What's going on here? Shouldn't we publicize that? And maybe that's warrants a demonstration at North Florida saying, hey, why are you charging so much? One of the big problems with both the insurance companies and the health systems is they really aren't accountable and they're not very transparent. So we never know what's going on to complain about it. And one of our big goals at RCA is to pull the curtain back. But and then very exciting, one of our members now, Don Davis, is going to become a patient representative for UF Health. So when the new protocols come through, that committee will give insights or comments on whether that protocol is patient friendly. Is that what we really want? We're both working from the outside and from the inside. And actually, I like the idea of inside even better, in that if we can get our message across through the structures that are already in place for our health systems, that would be terrific. But I think there's so much to do. And each of us can, I always tell medical students when we're talking about improving quality and safety, one little step seems very small, but multiple little steps is a big step. So if we all take one little step, seeming that it doesn't make an effect, all of us taking that step together will be a big step and will have impact. And there's William Sloan Coffin often said, if you volunteer for something, you don't know if you're going to make a difference. However, if you don't volunteer, you know you're not going to make a difference.
That's a good point. And Julia, I know we don't have a Right Care Alliance chapter there yet in your community. What can people do to get involved? What would you recommend on your side?
Well, I think, you know, Fred is right. Things like joining organized groups like Right Care Alliance. And I think you can be part of the Right Care Alliance without a local chapter, to just support them, to become a member, to certainly see if you can become on a patient council at your local hospital. But if that level is not comfortable for you, smaller things can be to take the time to write an email or a letter back to the hospital after you've left to give them your feedback. Now, they may not even respond, and probably a lot of the times they won't, or you'll get a stop letter back. Thank you for your response. But when they hear the same things over and over again, they will start to listen, because hospitals compete with each other. They want to have good reviews. They want to seem like they're the place in their community for people to go to. So give that feedback to the hospital about their staff, about cleanliness, about your experience there. Go ahead and share all of that. Certainly reach out to local reporters that you've read their stories, somebody who writes about healthcare regularly. Email them and say, I'd like to see more reports from you about this. Please write about this issue. And then social media. If you have a social media account, post on there about your experiences, good and bad. Little steps like that can be important.
Those are great points. Things that people wouldn't think of. I would have never thought about writing back to the hospital. It makes perfect sense. And I know Sharon and Victoria, you both work extensively in your community. So I know you do anything from the little things all the way to the big things. And I say thank you both for all that you do in our communities and being members in the Right Care Alliance and making the bigger difference. I agree. I think all of our voices together, they're soft when it's one, they're very loud when it's many. And we can make that difference. And we've shown it before, and we're going to do it again. So I want to thank all of our guests, Dr. Southwick, your book, Playing with Bees, available on Amazon. Julia Halsey, your book, The Empowered Patient, also available on Amazon, an excellent read. I recommend everybody check that out. Excellent information in there. I want to thank all of our listeners, both live tonight and then those that will be listening to the podcast later. We urge each one of you to get involved with your healthcare and be a voice in your communities.
Thank you for joining us for our conversation on advocating in healthcare. We hope you found this episode helpful and insightful. For more information about this and other topics, please visit therightcarealliance.org. And engagedpatients.org. If you'd like to join our organization or find out how you can become more involved in creating a better healthcare system for everyone, please contact the Gainesville chapter of the Right Care Alliance. This has been a presentation of the Right Care Alliance, all rights reserved, copyright 2024.